Hi, you're with Truth News Radio Australia on the 1st of October 2016. My name's Hereward Fenton. Welcome aboard. Today, I want to delve into the whole concept of mass media mind control by way of playing for you a speech given by Aldous Huxley in 1962 at Berkeley University. Now, this is a well-known speech. It's been featured in a number of documentaries, and many people may be familiar with it. But I feel it's important at this point in time to revisit some of the profound observations that have come from eminent people like Huxley about the reality of the manipulation of the population in modern society by sophisticated means, the manipulation of people in a sense that is that they are not aware of, that is done in such a clever way that they don't realize that their choices, that the content of their mind is actually being regulated, and even their desires and their perception of choice is controlled. And when we hear someone like Huxley talking about this, and indeed so long ago, this forces us to recognize that it's not just a conspiracy theory. It's not just a fantasy that this is going on. And when we look at recent events, and particularly looking at the truly bizarre and sick nature of the manipulation of public opinion around the US elections, it's just really important to understand that this had been foreseen, that this is really happening, and that we have to steel ourselves, we have to wake up out of the trance, and we have to do everything we can to wake others up. The presidential debate, which took place last week, has been the focus of such an incredibly sinister manipulation of public opinion, to the extent that all the online opinion polls, which showed that Trump was way ahead in terms of popularity during the debate, they've all been suppressed or scoffed at by the mainstream media, and the mainstream media just continues to pour out vitriolic attacks on Donald Trump, while at the same time propping up Hillary with very, very softball kind of criticism. And, you know, if you just do a Google search on Trump versus Clinton, and you just read the articles that pop up in Google, and of course Google is very much part of the co-opted plan to manipulate public opinion, it's just staggering what they're doing. And it demonstrates that that obviously they hate this guy, right? Obviously that they are determined to crush Trump. B, that they believe that they can just do it by telling people what to think, and that this is, it just comes second nature to them. They've been doing it so long, and it does work with a large swathe of the population. So they just continue to pour out these articles. I mean, let me just do a test for you right now. I'm just going to put Trump into Google and search on the news articles related to Trump. And just reading some of the articles here that pop up. Clinton calls Trump temperamentally unfit to lead. Trump's long pattern of attacking women's sex lives. Congresswoman defends Trump's 5 a.m. sex tweet. Video of Trump acknowledging business losses released. Trump under oath planned to call Mexicans rapists. Why is Donald Trump tweeting about a sex tape at 5 a.m.? How Donald Trump could disappear from the political scene? Donald Trump definitely wants to be president, right? Now, let me just quickly put Clinton into Google. And again, we'll search on news. And oddly enough, we see more articles attacking Trump. Trump opens new line of attack on Hillary Clinton. Clinton calls Trump temperamentally unfit to lead. Trump deepens attack on former Miss Universe. Trump took Clinton's bait on Alicia Machado. So even when we search on Clinton, we're seeing all these articles that basically attack Trump. But nothing that attacks Hillary Clinton, nothing. Clinton leads by 6 points in Nevada. Republicans fear Trump is playing into Clinton's hands. Clinton launches final stage turnout plan. Trump is more unpopular than Clinton is. One slightly negative article, Hillary Clinton's young people problem. So it's clear that the mainstream media, and this is worldwide, this is from New York to Sydney to Berlin to Paris to London, this is the entire Western world's media, is determined to crush and expunge Donald Trump. So this has two effects. On the one hand, it works as intended, and a vast number of people who trust the mainstream media, incredibly, even well-educated people, even fairly intelligent people, who you think would know better, they just can't believe that they would be lied to on such a scale. So they, and it's coming at them from all different sides, so they just think there must be something to it. Where there's smoke, there's fire. They think Trump must be a terrible, terrible person. And they really fall hook, line and sinker for the all of the attacks on him based on really trivial aspects of his behaviour, like whether he was rude to somebody and whether he's sexist and these types of things, while ignoring the absolutely chilling statements that have come from Hillary Clinton that threaten world peace and could lead us into a catastrophic scenario of world war that could kill billions of people. But now a secondary effect is actually, ironically, and I think this may be not intended, that it has actually increased his allegiance and probably increased his popularity generally amongst people who are suspicious of the mainstream media. And this is a larger group than ever before, largely because of the increasingly blatant lying that has been engaged in by the mainstream media for so long. People are actually starting to become aware that we have a big problem here. And this actually leads people to gravitate towards Trump simply for that very reason, that because he's being attacked by known liars, there must be something right about him. And to be honest with you, I'm in that camp too. I mean, I do actually have a lot of criticism of Trump in terms of some of the statements that he's made, banning Muslims from entering America, saying he wants to bring back torture. And I've talked about these on the show before. These are pretty terrible things to say. And I, you know, totally don't support them. But one tends to overlook that with the weight of all the other things that he's said and his clear position of challenging the authority of the ruling oligarchies of the United States and the world. Now, as I said at the beginning, I want to play to you this lecture. Not all of it, we won't have time, but I want to play to you some of it, and I'll put some of my comments in. A lecture given by Aldous Huxley a long, long time ago, more than 50 years ago. And, you know, it predicts so much that we're seeing in the world now. And it will help us realize that that we're not crazy, that our perceptions of a type of a conspiratorial attempt to coerce millions and even billions of people on this planet through covert scientific means, through the media and through a bunch of other techniques, is really happening. Now, Aldous Huxley has been often attacked as being part of that conspiracy, and I have to say I totally reject that. Huxley was an intellectual. He was aware of the trends. He was familiar with the type of people who are behind this agenda. But he is one of the few people in history who actually exposed their agenda. And we really do need to be thankful for Aldous Huxley. I think that there's a trend in a lot of the expositions that you see on the internet, a lot of the people who set themselves up as sort of bringing this information to you, to fall into just a totally negative, aggressive, cynical, and somewhat ignorant perspective on someone like Aldous Huxley, because they don't understand the true value of what he did in his books, particularly Brave New World, and in his writings and public speeches, where he was actually providing a very, very important service for the future of all humanity. So we're just going to break now, and when we come back, I'm going to bring to you that speech, and you know, I'll just give a few thoughts of my own as we play through it. And as we're listening to it, consider what's happening in the world right now. It's very, very interesting. With Truth News Radio Australia, we're going to break. We'll be right back. Welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio. So, as I promised, here is the speech from the University of Berkeley in 1962. The title he gave to this speech was The Ultimate Revolution.
Mr. Huxley has recently returned from a conference at the Institute for the Study of Democratic Institutions in Santa Barbara, where the discussion focused on the development of new techniques by which to control and direct human behavior. Traditionally, it has been possible to suppress individual freedom through the application of physical coercion, through the appeal of ideologies, through the manipulation of man's physical and social environment, and more recently through the cruder techniques of psychological conditioning. The ultimate revolution about which Mr. Huxley will speak today concerns itself with the development of new behavioral controls which operate directly upon the psychophysiological organisms of man, that is, the capacity to replace external constraint by internal compulsions. As those of us who are familiar with Mr. Huxley's works well know, this is a subject with which he has been concerned for quite a period of time. Mr. Huxley will make a presentation of approximately half an hour, followed by some brief discussions and questions by the two panelists sitting to my left, Ms. Lillian Rivlin and Mr. John Post. And Mr. Huxley.
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to say that the conference at Santa Barbara was not directly concerned with the control of the mind. That was a conference, there have been two of them now, at the University of California Medical Center in San Francisco, one this year, which I didn't attend, and one 2 years ago, where there was a considerable discussion on this subject. At Santa Barbara, we were talking about technology in general and the effects it's likely to have on society and the problems related to technological transplanting of technology and technology into underdeveloped countries. Well, now, in regard to this problem of the ultimate revolution, this has been very well summed up by the moderator. In the past, we can say that all revolutions have essentially aimed at changing the environment in order to change the individual. I mean, there's been the political revolution, the economic revolution. In the time of the Reformation, the religious revolution. All these aimed, as I say, not directly at the human being, but at his surroundings, so that by modifying the surroundings, you did achieve at one remove an effect upon the human being. Today, we are faced, I think, with the approach of what may be called the ultimate revolution, the final revolution, where a man can act directly on the mind-body of his fellows. Well, needless to say, some kind of direct action on human mind-bodies has been going on since the beginning of time. But this has generally been of a violent nature. The techniques of terrorism have been known from time immemorial, and people have employed them with more or less ingenuity, sometimes with the utmost crudity, sometimes with a good deal of skill acquired by a process of trial and error, finding out what the best ways of using torture, imprisonment, constraints of various kinds. But as I think it was Metternich said many years ago, you can do everything with bayonets except sit on them. That if you are going to control any population for any length of time, you must have some measure of consent. It's exceedingly difficult to see how pure terrorism can function indefinitely. It can function for a fairly long time, but I think sooner or later you have to bring in an element of persuasion, an element of getting people to consent to what is happening to them. Well, it seems to me that the nature of the ultimate revolution with which we are now faced is precisely this, that we are in process of developing a whole series of techniques which will enable the controlling oligarchy, who have always existed and presumably always will exist, to get people actually to love their servitude. This is, seems to me, the ultimate in malevolent revolution, shall we say. And this is a problem which has interested me for many years. And
I just want to pause it there to note a couple of things. Firstly, to emphasize the fact that Huxley is certainly not supportive of this, and he's clearly calling it malevolent. Just to clarify that for some of the people who think that Huxley was sort of part of the conspiracy. The point that he makes that the oligarchies have always been in control and presumably always will be in control. You see, people don't talk like that anymore. People don't even... What's actually happened in the last 50 years is that we're not even allowed to talk about the oligarchy. I mean, we do on this show, and people who are lumped as conspiracy theorists do, but everyone else says, oh, no, no, there's no such thing as an oligarchy. We're all free. We're all just, free individuals, and we vote in elections, and, oh, no, there's no one controlling us. This is actually part of the ingenious way that people have been led into a deeper servitude than possibly has ever existed before, because they're completely unaware. But there's a psychological conditioning at work where people are not aware of the gatekeeper. They're not aware of the jail guard, of the puppet masters who are controlling, even as they speak, what they think. And just one other point to note is that the use of terrorism has certainly been maintained. And this may be slightly at odds with what Huxley is saying. And, of course, Huxley was only, broad brush trying to predict the future, and certainly a lot of what he said is true. But also a lot of the older, cruder techniques are still at work. But one of the more sophisticated, more modern techniques, which still employs fear but on a more subdued level, is this, I think Noam Chomsky called it the manufacturing of consent, whereby we are given a spectrum with two main choices on your left and right, and where we are encouraged to choose one of those. And, in the case of, say, Trump versus Clinton, we are given a very stark choice, and it looks like it's been set up that the majority of people will go towards Clinton, because Trump has been set up as this very, very unpleasant kind of boogeyman. But I think, in a way, they've been too clever. Maybe, indeed, Trump was expected to behave slightly differently to the way he did. Maybe it wasn't expected. Maybe he was in on it and then went rogue. There's a lot of possibilities here. But clearly, he's been set up to be the person that you don't vote for, despite all of the problems with Hillary, because he says nasty things to women, etc., etc. So this is a method of manipulating people without their becoming aware of it. So just returning now to Aldous Huxley.
About which I wrote 30 years ago, a fable, The Brave New World, which is essentially the account of a society making use of all the devices at that time available, and some of the devices which I imagined to be possible, making use of them in order to, first of all, to standardize the population, to iron out inconvenient human differences.
We are just going to break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia, playing to you here a clip by Aldous Huxley. We'll be back after the break. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. And I'm just going to continue playing now from Aldous Huxley's speech. He's beginning now to talk about his book Brave New World and how this came out of a vision of his understanding that societies could be manipulated by more by the carrot than the stick. Anyway, let's just continue here with the Huxley speech.
To create, so to say, mass-produced models of human beings arranged in some kind of a scientific caste system. And since then I have continued to be extremely interested in this problem, and I have noticed with increasing dismay that a number of the predictions which were purely fantastic when I made them 30 years ago have come true or seem in process of coming true, that a number of techniques about which I talked seem to be here already, and that there seems to be a general movement in the direction of this kind of ultimate revolution, this method of control by which people can be made to enjoy a state of affairs which by any decent standard they ought not to enjoy. The enjoyment of servitude. Well, this process, as I say, has gone on for over the years, and I become more and more interested in what is happening. And here I would like briefly to compare the parable of Brave New World with another parable which was put forth more recently in George Orwell's book 1984. Orwell wrote his book between 45 and 48, at the time when the Stalinist terror regime was still in full swing, and just after the collapse of the Hitlerian terror regime. And his book, which I admire greatly, it's a book of very great talent and extraordinary ingenuity, shows, it's so to say, a projection into the future of the immediate past, of what for him was the immediate past, and the immediate present. It was a projection into the future of a society where control was exercised wholly by terrorism and the violent attacks upon the mind body of individuals. Whereas my own book, which was written in 1932, when there was only a mild dictatorship in the form of Mussolini in existence, was not overshadowed by the idea of terrorism, and I was therefore free, in a way which Orwell was not free, to think about these other methods of control, these non-violent methods. And I'm inclined to think that the scientific dictatorships of the future, and I think there are going to be scientific dictatorships in many parts of the world, will be probably a good deal nearer to the Brave New World pattern than to the 1984 pattern. They will be a good deal nearer, not because of any humanitarian qualms in the scientific dictators, but simply because the Brave New World pattern is probably a good deal more efficient than the other. That if you can get people to consent to the state of affairs in which they are living, the state of servitude, the state of being, having their differences ironed out and being made amenable to mass production methods on the social level, if you can do this, then you are likely to have a much more stable, a much more lasting society, a much more easily controllable society than you would if you were relying wholly on clubs and firing squads and concentration camps. So that my own feeling is that the 1984 picture was tinged, of course, by the immediate past and the present in which Orwell was living, but that the past and present of those years does not represent, I feel, the likely trend of what is going to happen. Needless to say, we shall never get rid of terrorism. This will always find its way to the surface. But I think that insofar as dictators become more and more scientific, more and more concerned with a technically perfectly running society, they will be more and more interested in the kind of techniques which I imagined and described from existing realities in Brave New World. So that it seems to me then that this ultimate revolution is really not very far away, that we already a number of the techniques for bringing about this kind of control are here, and it remains to be seen when and where and by whom they will first be applied in any large scale. And first, let me talk about a little bit about the improvement even in the techniques of terrorism. I think there have been improvements. Pavlov, after all, made some extremely profound observations, both on animals and on human beings, and he found, among other things, conditioning techniques applied to animals or humans in a state either of psychological or physical stress sank in, so to say, very deeply into the mind-body of the creature, and were extremely difficult to get rid of, that they seem to be embedded more deeply than other forms of conditioning. And this, of course, this fact, I think, was discovered empirically in the past. People did make use of many of these techniques. But the difference between the old empirical intuitive methods and our own methods is the difference between a sort of hit-and-miss craftsman's point of view and the genuinely scientific point of view. I mean, I think there is a real difference between ourselves and, say, the inquisitors of the 16th century. We know much more precisely what we are doing than they knew, and we can extend, because of our theoretical knowledge, we can extend what we are doing over a wider area with a greater assurance of producing something which really works. In this context, I would like to mention the extremely interesting chapters in Dr. William Sargent's Battle for the Mind, where he points out how intuitively some of the great religious teachers, leaders of the past, hit on the Pavlovian method. He speaks specifically of Wesley's method of producing conversions, which were essentially based upon a technique of heightening psychological stress to the limit by talking about hellfire, and so making people extremely vulnerable to suggestion, and then suddenly releasing this stress by offering hopes of heaven. And this is a very interesting chapter, showing how completely, on purely intuitive and empirical grounds, a skilled natural psychologist, as Wesley was, could discover these Pavlovian methods.
Just pause it there, and just consider what he said in the context of September 11, 2001, the use of psychological stress as a way to make people more vulnerable to basically take on conditioning and then to follow and accept a solution that is provided to them. And the psychological stress of what happened on 9/11 was extremely powerful because of the symbolic meaning of destroying those towers. That this was indeed maybe the greatest modern example of the true scientific use of terrorism, scientific terrorism, primarily aimed at the symbolic mind to make you more vulnerable and more open to coercion and conditioning. We're going to break. We'll be right back.
What happens in terms of creating wars is a mind manipulation technique called problem-reaction-solution. And it works like this. First of all, you create the problem, but you get someone else to be blamed for it. You then report that problem through the media in the way you want it reported. You get the public to react to your problem by saying, something must be done, this can't go on, what are they going to do about it?
Hi, welcome back. I just want to continue on that thought from the last segment about the use of terror as a primarily psychological conditioning that doesn't necessarily involve physical violence to the main targets that the terrorism is aimed at. For example, September 11, the population of America, a certain number of people were killed. We all got to see that, and we got to see them falling out of buildings or jumping out of buildings, the most horrific thing you can imagine, the terror, the horror, but we got to see it on television, millions of people got to see it live, and then there's a transference of an emotion which then creates a psychological stress state which makes people more open to conditioning. So this is terrorism, but it's terrorism of a more sophisticated nature, and it does involve violence, but it doesn't involve violence on the crude scales that we've seen in the past. It can be quite a small number of, a small number of killings, a small circumscribed amount of violence, but which through media and through the careful choice of symbols is able to spread fear, and not just naked fear, not just sort of primal fear, but almost a deeper fear illustrated by the destruction of things that are of great symbolic meaning and power in people's minds, such as the destruction of the Twin Towers. I'm just trying to illustrate here that the truly scientific evolution of terrorism that Aldous Huxley is describing in this speech has indeed taken place, ladies and gentlemen. So let me just continue now with the speech. We've got one more segment here, and I'll get as much of this in as we can. Here we go.
Well, as I say, we now know the reason why these techniques worked, and there's no doubt at all that we can, if we want to, carry them much further than was possible in the past. And of course, in the history of recent history of brainwashing, both as applied to prisoners of war and to the lower personnel within the Communist Party in China, we see that the Pavlovian methods have been applied systematically and evidently with extraordinary efficacy. I mean, I think that can be no doubt that by the application of these methods, a very large army of totally devoted people has been created. The conditioning has been driven in, so to say, by a kind of psychological iontophoresis, into the very depth of the people's being, and has got so deep that it's very difficult for it ever to be rooted out. And these methods, I think, are a real refinement on the older methods of terror, because they combine methods of terror with methods of acceptance, method that the person who he is subjected to a form of terroristic stress, but for the purpose of inducing a kind of voluntary, quotes, acceptance of the state and the psychological state into which he has been driven, and the state of affairs within which he finds himself. So that, as I say, there has been, I think, a definite improvement, shall we say, even in the techniques of terrorism. Well, then we come to the consideration of other techniques, of non-terroristic techniques for inducing consent and for inducing people to love their servitude. Here, I mean, I think we can... I don't think I can possibly go into all of them because I don't know all of them, but I mean, I can mention a few of the more obvious methods which can now be used and which are based upon recent scientific findings. First of all, there are the methods connected with straight suggestion and hypnosis. I think we know much more about this subject than was known in the past. People, of course, have always known about suggestion, and although they didn't know the word hypnosis, they certainly practiced it in various ways. But we have, I think, a much greater knowledge of the subject than in the past, and we can make use of our knowledge in ways which I think the past was probably never able to make use of it. For example, one of the things we now know for certain is that there is, of course, an enormous, I mean, this has been always known, a very great difference between individuals in regard to their suggestibility. But we now, I think, know pretty clearly the sort of statistical structure of a population in regard to its suggestibility. It's very interesting when you look at the findings in different fields. I mean, in the field of hypnosis, in the field of administering placebos, for example, in the field of general suggestion in states of drowsiness or of light sleep, you will find the same sorts of orders of magnitude continually cropping up. You will find, for example, that the experienced hypnotists will tell one that the percentage of people who can be hypnotized with the utmost facility, just like that, is about 20%. That about a corresponding number at the other end of the scale are very, very difficult or almost impossible to hypnotize, and that in between there lies a large mass of people who can, with more or less difficulty, be hypnotized, they can gradually be, if you work hard enough at it, be got into the hypnotic state. And in the same way, the same sort of figures crop up again, for example, in relation to the administration of placebos. So a big experiment was carried out 3 or 4 years ago in the General Hospital in Boston on post-operative cases where several hundred men and women suffering comparable kinds of pain after serious operations were given injections whenever they asked for them, whenever the pain got bad, and the injections 50% of the time were of morphine and 50% of the time were of distilled water, and about 20% of those who went through the experiment, about 20% of them got just as much relief from the distilled water as from the morphia. About 20% got no relief from the distilled water, and in between were those who got some relief or got relief occasionally. So here again we see the same sort of distribution. And similarly with regard to what in Brave New World I call hypnopedia, which is the sleep teaching. I was talking not long ago to a man who manufactures records which people can listen to during the light part of sleep. I mean, these are records for getting rich, for sexual satisfaction, for confidence in salesmanship, and so on. And he said it's very interesting that records are sold on a money-back basis, and he says that there is regularly between 15 and 20% of people who write indignantly saying the records don't work at all, and he sends the money back at once. There are, on the other hand, there are somewhat over 20% who write enthusiastically, saying they are now much richer, their sexual life is much better, etc., etc. And these, of course, are the dream clients, and they buy more of these. And then in between are those who complain they're not getting much results, and they have to have letters written to them saying, well, go persist, my dear, go on, and you will get there. And they generally... they generally do get results in the long run.
Okay, I'm just going to have to stop it there because we're almost at the end of the hour. I just want to relate this to the political scenario where you have, again, the attempt to manipulate people on a grand scale using a whole variety of suggestive tactics. And these are part of memes that have been around for a long time. And what we've seen in the Trump versus Clinton sort of contest is the use of the memes about behavior, about political correctness, some of which comes under the umbrella of what we call cultural Marxism, but a whole lot of directives about how people should behave and what's good and what's bad, and kind of shaming people about certain behaviors and sort of magnetizing them towards certain concepts, which even goes into things like the environment and climate change. And again, touches a little bit on fear, because fear is still important in all this as a coercive factor, but more about the use of suggestive and imagery and words like sexist, racist, bigoted, bully, which we've seen, of course, used against Trump, homophobic. And these suggestive words are used again and again and again to manipulate people and to move people to implant suggestions into people. And, of course, repetition is the key to it. It has to be done over and over and over again to be effective, and that's indeed how hypnosis works. And then, you know, we do see the 20% that can be easily manipulated gravitating in one direction, the 20% that are immune to that gravitating in another direction, and then we see this bulk in the middle sort of swinging. And, you know, at the moment in the US elections, they keep saying Hillary is slightly ahead, 5 points ahead, and indeed this may be what they've planned all along, that she will just win the election by being just 5 points ahead. Everyone will believe she's 5 points ahead, and then with a little bit of vote rigging, they can make her win anyway, even if she's not really 5 points ahead. In which case, this whole thing has been pre-planned. That's about all I've got to say for this week. I hope you found that interesting. I'll be back next week. Truth News Radio Australia, signing out.